Hey, out there in podcast land, I thought I'd just yammer at you about some various things that have been on my mind lately. This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a licensed therapist and I'm a professor. If you could like us on Facebook, that'd be cool. And it'd be cool for you as well. You get a benefit by being able to participate in our weekly Tough or Bluff games that we play on Tuesday. That's called Tuesday Tough or Bluff. So if you go to Facebook and like us, then you'll get those updates every Tuesday. I don't spam at all, at least I don't think so, on Facebook, so I wouldn't worry about that. You can also review us on iTunes or email us, or you can go to our website and donate, people. Please donate. That would be nice of you. All right, so I wanted to talk today about countertransference for a little bit. I've talked about it before, but I just want to give a little update to you therapists out there that never underestimate your brain's ability to protect yourself from difficult thoughts. Understand that when you have a thought that is difficult for you, that is shameful, or that is somewhat out of your awareness, don't underestimate your brain's ability to hide that from you. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because I've run into a few situations recently with supervisees and with students in which when I talk with them about their potential countertransference, they seem to be a little surprised that I'm even bringing it up. And I'll say something like, you know, so is it possible that your countertransference is affecting the way that you're seeing the situation right now? Because that's the way it seems to me. It seems like your anger toward the client is affecting the way that you're languaging the client. You know, you're consulting with me. You're telling me about how you see the client, and it seems as though your anger with your anger with your father, or your anger with your ex-spouse, or your anger with your children, or whatever kind of personal issue you have, it seems like it might be a factor here. And I, you know, as a supervisor and a teacher, I'll never know if the answer is yes to that. Only the clinician knows the answer to that. And so I'm not saying that I know, but when I ask the question, sometimes I get this response of like, huh? Well, you know, like, well, I don't think so. And what I often think is I'm not very confident in the response from people. And so if you're a therapist out there, you know, really just take the time to contemplate for yourself and consult. And if someone says something, you know, like, you know, do you think your countertransference might be affecting the situation? Really take the time to think about that, because it's totally normal to have countertransference. In fact, a lot of people believe it's ubiquitous and present in all situations therapeutically. Some research have found, even when you have a conservative definition of countertransference, that 80% of sessions involve some level of countertransference. And so it's really the norm. It's really normal to do. And in particular, if you're a novice therapist, if you're just starting out, your issues will impact the way you see the clients, your clients, for the rest of your life. Your personal life will color the way you see all of your clients. It's just the way that it is. There's just no way around that. However, when you're just starting out, you don't necessarily have the routines and the practices and the wisdom and the habits that you will have later on. You know, when you've been a therapist for 30 years, I'm guessing you'll have a much better ability at noticing your countertransference and managing it more effectively. It's not reasonable to think that when you're just starting out that you would have that ability right out of the gate, especially when you haven't ever practiced it before. So it's totally normal to, you know, have someone ask you, like myself, what countertransference is at play, and for you to stop and think, huh, I'm not quite sure what countertransference is at play. And I have this knee-jerk reaction to say, I don't have any countertransference, but I've been told that that isn't likely, so I'm going to have to give that some thought. Now, if someone responded like that, I'd say, kudos to you, my friend. That is a very wise response. The response of, I don't know, is, in my opinion, often quite wise. I wish I said it more often, honestly. Sometimes I jump to answers and then later think, you know what, I just should have said I don't know. So not only that response, or, yeah, well, I've given it some thought, and I think it might have something to do with the fact that I got in a fight with my spouse last night and therefore am a little shaken up by that. And I think that affects the way that I'm seeing this situation. Maybe I'm overcompensating. I don't know. And, you know, well, what do you think? You know, do you think I'm overcompensating? You know, so it just becomes a conversation at that point. And I guess I'll close the discussion of countertransference by talking about a few signs as to that you can look for as to indications about countertransference. For instance, if you're blaming one person in the family, if you're blaming your client or you're blaming someone that they're related to, if you're targeting someone as the reason why the problem exists, that's a potential sign that countertransference has taken over and heavily influenced the way that you see the situation. Now, that might be the helpful way to see the situation. I don't know, but that's an indicator often is when you're really blaming one person. Another sign might be you've lost the ability to be empathic or to be sympathetic with everyone involved. You know, not only the client, the individual client or the, you know, family that's come in, but the people that they talk about. If you've lost the ability to be compassionate towards these people, towards everybody involved, then that might be an indication that countertransference is affecting you, that you've either been induced by the family system or there's something in your past that is coming up for you and you're being triggered and it's making you have difficulty being compassionate. And this brings me to a larger point, actually, is that you can't, this is directed towards graduate students and novice therapists, and I guess really anybody. You can't expect by the end of your graduate program that you will master these extremely complicated topics and skills. You can't expect to do that. There's been a couple times in the past couple weeks where I've had students say to me things like, I thought I was good at this sort of stuff, or I'm having a hard time with you telling me that I'm not up to par here, or that I haven't achieved this competency or whatever. And when I hear that, I'm really quite surprised, because what is the chance that you as a student will know something before you take the class? Is the thought I have. I think, you know, the fact that you don't know it is normal. If you knew it, then you would have obviously taken this class before or studied this topic before, and therefore you didn't need to take this class. That's the whole purpose of taking a class, is that you don't know something, and it's my job as a professor to impart that knowledge upon you, and then you do a number of exercises and develop those competencies. You absorb that knowledge, you metabolize that knowledge, and you develop skills, you know, that you didn't have prior. And so when I hear students say, oh, I thought I was good at this, I just think, how could that be? And sometimes I wonder, am I being harder on students than other professors and they're just getting by in the other classes? Or I know that that's actually a common thought that instructors have, that, you know, every instructor thinks, oh, I'm special and I'm the best and everyone else, every other instructor is terrible, and my way is the best way. So I hesitate to think something stupid like that. But sometimes I wonder, because for some students late in their program, I hear statements like that and I think it's not likely that you were very good at this prior to this class, because again, you're in school to learn. And it's totally normal. So I don't have a problem with students or supervisees who don't know something. I'll never, ever have a problem with someone who doesn't know something or isn't very practiced at something. What I do kind of have a problem with is early career therapists who think they already know everything and are surprised when I tell them that they have an area of growth to work on. That I do kind of worry about, because what it worries me is that they, how do I word this? They might believe a false notion that they're already awesome at something, that they are done learning, and that never ends. You know, that's the one thing that I've found about wise, experienced therapists is when I talk to them, they're really quite humble about how much they know and what they don't know, and they're very willing, in my experience, wise older therapists. They're very willing to say, you know what, I don't know much about that. That's something that I don't know much about. And that's something that I really try to aspire to. I really try to aspire to a place of when I'm in a situation where someone says something to me, I really try to think, and I don't always succeed, I really try to think, oh, you know what? It's okay that I don't know that. Or that's okay that that was once explained to me, but now it's not coming to mind. Or that's okay that I don't have an intelligent response to that. Or that's okay that I made that mistake. It's okay. And I totally expected. It's akin to, for me, I'm just trying to think of another field that's as complicated as psychotherapy. I guess in the medical field, I guess it would be like, you know, someone takes a number of biology classes and chemistry classes and this sort of whatever med students take, and then they do their first rotation at a hospital, and their supervisor says something like, well, your diagnosis isn't very, what your diagnosis is fine, but it doesn't recognize these differential diagnoses, and I see that you didn't consider them. If that person said, oh, well, I'm surprised. I've never heard anyone say that I wasn't perfect as a physician already. I mean, that's what it's like when I'm talking to students. It's that absurd to me. And I'm just guessing that you can see the absurdity in it. Therapy is extremely complicated. Being a human is extremely complicated, and when you're a therapist, you have to understand, or at least strive to understand yourself as best as you can. The fact that you don't understand yourself is normal, right? Or the fact that you don't fully understand yourself is normal. So I just encourage everyone out there, and I will remind myself that we should remain humble and should remain in the knowledge that we don't know everything, and we probably barely know anything, and that is okay, and that is good. My cat agrees. Which leads me to another point that's related to this, is that we should all try not to be smart. This is a little speech I give my students every now and then, because I find that a lot of students, including myself, honestly, when I was a student, that we all try to be really smart, that we don't want to be dumb, that when we talk in class or when we turn a paper in or when we take a test, we're all pretty desperate to be on top. We want to be the smart one, or at least not the dumb one, right? And so the teacher calls on us and we get really nervous that we want to seem smart to everybody. Now, I think this has there's a number of reasons for this, and one of them is that a lot of people in graduate school, a lot of the students that I talk to, these are top of the classers. These are students that did very well throughout their entire life. You know, from day one, they were getting good grades, and they got their bachelor's degree, and now they're getting their master's or their doctorate. And these are smart cookies, and they're not used to being in a room full of other smart cookies. So that's part of it, is they were in the past able to just kind of coast and come across like the smart one. And so they have a lot of self-esteem around that, and now they can't really rely on that. And plus, the topic of therapy is too complicated to ever feel smart about. And so that just naturally triggers them. I think it also has to do with this cultural notion that therapists are geniuses, that in order to be a good therapist, you have to be a genius. In order to be a therapist, you have to be really analytical and articulate. And these are not necessarily These skills are not necessary to be a good therapist. They can help, but you don't have to be articulate to be a good therapist, and you don't have to be a genius by any means to be a good therapist. You have to have compassion. I will put that forth. And even if you don't have compassion, you could probably fake it, honestly, or you could be a, you know, very good cognitive behavioral therapist that doesn't, you know, necessarily need a lot of compassion. You could teach a lot of skills, and you could, you know, you can be a therapist even without much compassion. But I will say that for a lot of therapy to work for a lot of clients, you need to have compassion, and that has nothing to do with intelligence. It has nothing to do with, you know, being a genius or something. And so, do you have compassion? Do you care about other human beings? Then, you know, that's, if you can answer yes to that, then you're probably good, and the rest of it will probably fall into place. So I just want to say to everyone out there that being smart is really a cultural thing that we don't have to buy into. And the other thing that I'll say that's related to that I sometimes tell students is that if you don't know something and you're in a class, then that's my fault because I'm your professor and it's my responsibility to have taught you that. It's not your fault. You're not the dumb one. You're trying hard because graduate school students try hard. They all try very hard. And they're paying a lot of money to do this sort of thing. It's their life calling to be a therapist. You know, they aren't doing this because their parents told them. They did this because a lot of them are doing it in spite of what their parents want. And so, you know, they're quite dedicated to this. And so if you're a student and you don't understand something, then that's not your fault. That's the professor's fault. And so if you feel dumb about something, blame the professor is really what I tell people. Blame me. That's my fault. It's my job to teach a class in such a way that you just have to sit back and, you know, do half of what I tell you to do and, you know, put in the regular amount of effort you put into all your things that you do in life. And by the end of the quarter, you should have learned something. And if you don't feel like you get it, then that's my fault. And you should, you know, yell at me about it. You pay a lot of money for school. You deserve professors that make learning easy for you. So that leads me to another topic, the topic of choosing the right program for you. Sometimes people will ask me about this sort of thing. And so I just thought I'd randomly talk about a few things. For instance, you should ask how long their internships are. There are accredited, shall we say, high-quality programs like my own, Couple and Family Therapy at Antioch University, Seattle, in which the internship length is 15-plus months. So the internship is more than a year, and by the end of that internship, you will have had at least 500 sessions. It's 500 individual sessions with couples and families and individuals. And now contrast that with other programs that might not be accredited. And because they want to have people graduate on time, or they don't really have the resources to get people into internships or whatever, their internship might be a quarter or two quarters, might be 6 months. And by the end of that 6 months, they might have only seen 50 sessions or 25 sessions or something. So contrast that with 500 sessions by the time you graduate. You can, you know, imagine that the people who graduate from these two programs are going to have a different level of experience. And the internship is extremely valuable. It provides you the time and the place to really, you know, get those initial skills down. I've had supervisees that come from other programs. So, you know, so people, if you don't know, they'll graduate from a therapy program. And after they graduate, they still need a supervisor. And so some people will hire me as their postgrad supervisor. And I've had some postgrads that have gone to other programs. And they tell me about their program. And they tell me about how little time they spent at their internship and how little training they got there and how little support they had there. And I am appalled because they graduated with almost no skills having developed, and it shows in their abilities. And so if you're looking for a program, one of the questions you might want to ask is how long the internships are and how many hours you will expect to get by the time you graduate. Now, I will say that most marriage and family therapy programs, like the one I teach at, will provide you with 500 hours. That's kind of the standard, but some don't. So just make sure that you ask. The other thing I'll say is you should probably ask around. You should, you know, word of mouth is a wonderful thing and can give you a lot of information. So ask around, you know, ask people in the field, or if you're interested in a therapy program, just call a local agency and ask, what could I talk to some of the therapists there about what programs they went to? And because I'm thinking about becoming a therapist, which leads me to another piece of advice is talk to professionals. Ask them what programs they went to and ask them about the field. Ask them what sort of training is necessary. I've had a lot of therapists come to me after going through a program or midway through a program, and they'll tell me that they chose the wrong program. But they've already invested so much money and energy into it, they really can't practically jump ship. Some programs are so specific to a particular field that if you jump ship, you basically lose all of that effort. And so you really have to make sure you're going to the right program. And I really feel bad for some people. And some people end up coming to my program and they've jumped ship and they basically just have to scrap most of what they did. Sometimes they can transfer credits, but often they can't for reasons that we can't control. Other questions you might want to ask are how many credits do they require? And, you know, it depends, but some programs require more credits than others. And so, you know, it's just one of those things you want to know. How long has the program been in business is another question you might want to ask them. In my experience, newer programs, say a program that 15 years or less, that's been around 15 years or less, these programs typically have wrinkles that are quite prominent, shall we say, that have yet to be ironed out. The wrinkles have yet to be ironed out in the programs. And whereas other programs have been around for several decades, for instance, again, my program, Couple and Family Therapy, Anik University of Seattle, this is turning into just a commercial for my program, but there are many other programs like mine, believe me, but programs that have been around for 30 plus years or something, these programs have ironed out a lot of their wrinkles. As a person who is soon to be chair of the program myself, and I've been basically chair for a long time, but as an administrator of a program, you realize how complicated marriage and family therapy or counseling or doctoral programs are. You realize how complicated they are and how little support you have to run the program. Basically, it's up to the professors to run the entire program, and it is extremely complicated, and over time, you just are able to address different issues as you go. You only have so much time in the week, and so you have to tackle the most difficult problems. You know, the biggest wrinkles get addressed first, right? And so if your program is only 10 years old, then you've only had 10 years to address the biggest wrinkles, and you still have a lot of, you know, issues with your program that have yet to be addressed. And so some people might think, oh, 10 years, that's a long time, but that's actually a very young program if it's only been around for 10 years. Also, you might want to ask, are they accredited? For instance, in marriage and family therapy, it's COAMFT or COAMFTE, the Commission, what is it, Commission of American, wait, I don't know, something marriage and family therapy education. I should know that. That is terrible that I don't know that. Don't tell anybody that I couldn't say that. I'm going to look it up. Oh my God, I should know. Commission on Accreditation for Marriage and Family Therapy Education. So, well, see, that's kind of weird. Commission on Accreditation. Commission on Accreditation for Marriage and Family Therapy Education. There's also KCREP or the American Psychological Association. These are all the top accreditors for programs. So you want to ask, are they accredited? Now, if they say, yes, we're accredited, that doesn't necessarily mean they're accredited by the top accreditor. They might be, their university might be accredited, but the program might not be. Or their program might be accredited by a particular organization that isn't really recognized as a rigorous accreditor. And so you just want to ask around about that. And it's complicated. And I don't envy people applying to programs because there's just a lot of things that you just won't know about until you're already done with the program. But that's one question you should ask. Another thing that I'll say, and you know, I'll probably get some hate mail on this, but in my opinion, you shouldn't worry about whether or not your professors are published or not, depending on what sort of thing you want to go into. If you want to go into publishing as a clinician or as a researcher or something, then you absolutely should look for professors that have been published, particularly in the field that you want to go into and the research area you want to go into. But if you want to be a therapist or a counselor, worrying about whether or not your professors have been published or not in journals and in books and this sort of thing is really, I think, missing the point. The reason why I say this is because in my field, in the field of therapy, psychotherapy, and marriage and family therapy, and psychology, the main metric, one of the main metrics upon which professors are measured is how many publications and the significance of those publications that they've had. You might have heard the phrase publish or perish. Well, that refers to professors in that they have to publish at least one significant thing a year is often one of the metrics, or else they'll be fired, or else they'll start being demoted in some way. And there's really people in two different camps in my field, and the people in my camp are quite, I consider us to be the minority. At Antioch University Seattle and the Couple and Family Therapy program and other programs, we don't emphasize publication for the professors. And the reason is because when we add up all the different things we want professors to do, publishing is one of them, but it's really secondary to a lot of other issues that we would rather have them spend their time on, like teaching the classes, right? When you teach classes, that eats away at your time for publishing. When we also want people to mentor students, both before graduate school, during graduate school, and after graduate school. We want the professors to take the time to care about those students, to help them develop professionally, to help them learn, to help them with their personal life, and to get them a job and to help them post-graduation, to help them with their career. And if they publish, if they're locked in a room writing the entire time, that's going to pull away from that time. Other things we want professors doing are serving on committees and going to meetings and these kinds of things. And again, when they do that, they can't be writing. And writing takes a lot of effing time. Holy crap, it does. So now, if someone wants, now I'm writing, and a lot of other professors are writing and doing research, and I've done research in the past. And so we definitely will do that, but it has to be balanced. And if we require all professors to publish constantly, then something's going to suffer. And often, in my opinion, teaching suffers. And students who go to teaching universities will often complain about this. For instance, I went to University of Washington, or what we call UW around here. And some of the classes that I was in, I was totally astonished at how terrible the teachers were. And it wasn't until I was later a professor myself that I figured out, oh, that was a professor that was hired on his researching abilities or his writing abilities or some other thing other than teaching. I mean, I had a math teacher once that I won't even go into details. He was just awful. He couldn't even speak loud enough for anyone to hear because he was so shy. And so when you have all these different requirements for professors that will conflict with the ability to teach, then the student experience will suffer. And ultimately, what we're doing in our program is we are training therapists to be therapists, and we're training people to get jobs. We're a training program. We're a career training program. We're not a philosophical training program. We're a program that should produce people that work in the field. We should be giving them the education and the experience that gives them a strong ability to be hired after graduation and start building a career. And if we don't do that, then we have not done our job. And when we publish, that almost has nothing to do with that goal. And so when you're asking around for different programs, my advice to you is not to focus on whether or not the professors are published, unless that's what you want to do. If that's what you want to do and you want to go into research, God help you, because funding is terrible. But if that's what you want to do, then yeah, you absolutely want to look at that. But if you just want to be a therapist or a counselor, I wouldn't emphasize that. Okay, that felt rather ranty to me, but let's move on. So another thing I wanted to talk about was a situation that came up for me recently with a student, with a supervisee, and the student was naturally quite worried about what was happening with her family client, and I'm going to describe it in a way that will be general, or well, I'll change details to mask the identity of the client, but essentially there is a custody battle between parents that were going through a divorce, but the parents haven't divorced yet. And the children were coming to therapy, and the therapist, my student supervisee, was seeing the mother and was seeing the father. And the father and the therapist had bonded. The father and the therapist had a good alliance, good working alliance, and had been doing therapy for a while. And so my supervisee really wanted the father to, you know, do well in life. And, you know, they had a good relationship. And so somehow the mother wanted to be involved in therapy. She knew that the father and the children were in therapy, but didn't participate much. I don't know exactly why, but at a certain point, the mother said that she wanted to participate. And so somehow the mother was invited into therapy. And then the therapist meets with the mother and has been hearing lots of bad things about the mother, incidentally, right? And so it's a little nervous about meeting with the mother, but she's okay. And so the therapist meets with the mother. The session goes, you know, fairly well for the most part for a first session. And then later that week, there's a custody battle hearing in court. And the father comes out of the courtroom and is very upset and comes to therapy and meets with the therapist, my supervisee, and says to the therapist, he says, "I can't believe that you did what you did, because when you met with my soon-to-be ex-wife, you must have told her things that you shouldn't have told her, and she used that information against me in court, and now I'm going to lose the custody battle with my soon-to-be ex-wife, and I'm wondering if that has to do now with this session that you had with them, had with her, and what you said." So essentially, my supervisee comes to me and says, "Oh my God, have I totally screwed up? Should I not have met with the mother? Should I not have said what I said? Now I've compromised my relationship with the husband and the children, and what if this custody battle goes all wrong and it's all because of what I said?" And this is a very common thing in family therapy, by the way. And there is often a lot of anxiety for everyone involved. So that was the first thing that I said, I think. But other things that I said, or at least I hope I said to her, the therapist, was that from the details that I got, and there were more details than that, it didn't seem like the therapist had done anything wrong. And in fact, it seemed like the therapist had done everything right. And so the issues are that courtrooms and custody battles, they always suck. They're always terrible. They're always stressful. Not always, but 99.9% of the time, they're stressful and terrible. And what happens is that you have parents that are divorcing, and they're often quite angry at each other because they're quite hurt by each other. And they start to become somewhat delusional about the other person, in that they see the other person as the enemy, and they see the other person as a terrible parent. When if you just, you know, rewound the tape 5 or 10 years and ask them what they thought of their spouse, they would have said, "Well, you know, my spouse has practices that aren't so great, but overall he or she's great." But because they're going through this divorce and because they're so hurt, they can't see that other person objectively. And then they have these lawyers that are being paid a lot of money, are fighting for their client, that they have an ethical duty to fight for their client, which means they have to start mudslinging they have to start attacking the other side. And so you have these two teams attacking each other in court. Well, what the divorcing spouses want when they go to court is they want the judge, who incidentally is now the parent on high of these fighting siblings. So the clients will transfer all of their parental issues onto the judge in all likelihood. And so they're looking for the judge to side with them. And the lawyer doesn't prepare their client, in my opinion, for this reality. And so both parties go into the courtroom, at least unconsciously, if not consciously, wanting the judge to side with them. And they'll bring in all their arguments and they feel strong. They wouldn't go to court unless they didn't feel strong. They feel strong about their opinions and they feel like they're going to win. And they feel like the other person, the person they're divorcing from, they feel like that person has no case at all. When in fact, they equally have just as much of a case. And when I look at these situations often, which is really the tragedy, it's just like both of you have equally strong things to say about the other person and neither of you are convincing, but you're all quite convinced of yourselves. And so they go into court and they want the judge to side with them, and the judge doesn't side with them. The judge listens to both sides because that's how the law works. The judge says, okay, soon-to-be ex-wife, tell me your side. Okay, soon-to-be ex-husband, tell me your side. Okay, I'm listening. I'm hearing evidence. And the lawyers will start, you know, saying lots of horrible things. And what both people, and I've worked with both people in situations like that, will leave the courtroom feeling as though their side was not heard. They'll feel as though the judge was unfair to them. Both people will say that when they leave the courtroom. They'll say, I was treated unfairly. They didn't listen to me. They didn't let me say all the things that I wanted to say. And the reason why they didn't let you say all the things that you wanted to say is because if they let you say all the things you wanted to say, you would be there for hours or you would never leave, because you don't just have a few facts you want to get off your chest. You have a lifetime you have 20 years of difficulty that you have to process. And you feel like if the judge just understood that, then they would be on your side. And so this is the problem with a lot of these, you know, court hearings, a lot of these custody battles. And it's why I've had previous episodes on collaborative divorce, which gets away from this whole adversarial system. But anyway, so I explained that in probably a shorter form, hopefully a shorter form to my supervisee as a way of trying to help her understand that, help her understand the context, that the fact that her client, the husband came back to her and said, I'm upset about what happened. I said, well, that was inevitable. And by explaining this, I was helping to normalize it for the therapist, but also for the therapist, the next time she's in that situation, the next time she's involved in a custody battle, that she doesn't get her hopes up that things are going to go well in those situations, because they almost never do. And that she can start preparing the parents for that. Because if I was in that situation, I would have told the husband before they went into the courthouse, I would have said just what I just said. I would have said, here's what's going to happen and it's not going to feel good. So you got to prepare yourself and you got to lower your expectations. And you might want to avoid going to court altogether, because what's the judge going to do? The things that a lot of parents want in custody battles is they'll say, look at all these things, all these reasons why my children should not have to deal with this other parent. Now, if you're dealing with an extremely abusive criminal addict of some sort, then yeah, you can make that case. But if they're not an addict and you can't prove that, or even if they are an addict, sometimes that's not even necessarily a good enough reason. But if they've only been mildly abusive, if they're anything short of that, pretty liberal threshold, the judge has a duty to uphold families and to preserve families. The judge doesn't have the right to just flippantly remove the ability for a parent to see a child. And so often, at least in Washington State, the custodies pan out, they just say right down the middle, or just 60-40 or something. And what a lot of parents want is they want to prove to the judge, like, look how terrible my spouse is. And that's a tough sell, because you're saying a lot of things that are your opinion, or that you were the only one that saw it. And it's hard to jump a very, very high hurdle to get a judge to say, okay, you've convinced me that this individual's rights to see their child should be taken away. You've convinced me. That's a tough sell. And so I will tell parents that. And so I was hoping that I could tell my supervisee the next time she runs into this sort of situation, or maybe even with this client, is to help families navigate that. Because there's really no one in their system that will give them that advice. Because the lawyers don't give them that advice. Some of them do. Some of them are really quite responsible with this. But often a lot of them aren't. You know, the father hires a lawyer and says, I want to fight for custody. And the lawyer says, okay, I will fight for custody. And, you know, what's the lawyer going to do? Is the lawyer going to say, no, I don't think we should fight for custody. You know, the customer is just going to go to another lawyer and say, I want you to fight for custody. You know, so the lawyer's hands are kind of tied to some extent. The judge isn't going to say anything because the judge doesn't have time to for that kind of stuff. And so it kind of falls on the therapist involved with the family to explain how this system works and to get to know how the system works. And so I, you know, that was one thing I said. The other thing that I tell a lot of people, and this is what I do, is just to avoid custody battles altogether. When I have clients come to me, and a lot of family therapists are like this, when I have clients come to me and tell me that they're in a custody battle, I say, okay, let's slow down here before we move forward. What do you want me to do? What's your goal for therapy? Because a lot of people, when they enter custody battles, they'll hire a therapist because they want the therapist to be an expert witness for their side, you know. So the father hires a therapist, and then the father says a bunch of things about the mother to the therapist. And then when it comes to the court custody hearing, they will subpoena the therapist and into the room, and, you know, to provide an opinion about the fitness of the mother, and to try to bolster the opinion that the mother is a bad parent. And these kinds of roles are really quite challenging for therapists, because we're trained to help and we're trained to build alliances with people. We're not trained to, you know, trump up evidence and to testify against people. That is not what we're trained to do. And we're not really trained to even evaluate whether or not someone is a good parent. You would think that family therapists, and a lot of people do, are trained to evaluate parenting, but we're not. We're trained to help parents, and we're trained to build parenting skills, and we're trained to help systems, and we're trained to help children, and we're trained to help and to heal, but we're not trained to evaluate and to report forensically to a court hearing. There are people that are trained to do that. There are psychologists that are specifically trained to provide parenting evaluations, and really those are the people that should be providing those forensic evaluations. Family therapists should not be, unless they're specifically trained in that. And so I tell people, look, as soon as you hear custody battle, start drawing boundaries, or don't even see that client, is just really the thing. Because sometimes clients aren't being very honest about what they want. They'll say, oh, I just want therapy, when in really, really they're just using you as another tool in their custody battle, if that makes any sense. And then suddenly you'll get the subpoena and you'll be like, what? I didn't even know they were thinking about, you know, pulling me into this. And all along, that's all they wanted to do. And they might even be coaching the children, you know, okay, Johnny, when you go to see the therapist, make sure you talk really badly about the other parent, because we need to make sure that they understand what's going on. And so the other thing is don't underestimate parents going through a custody battle. Don't underestimate the amount of effort they will put into trying to bolster their case when custody battles get really ugly. My God, I've seen custody battles go on for years, 6-7 years. I have an ex-client, a former client that still contacts me occasionally, that has been going through custody issues, I'm guessing, for 10 years. And it is just a mire that, as a therapist, is not very professionally rewarding, shall we say. Now, if you're the sort of therapist that loves that kind of thing and is trained to do that kind of thing and has supervision and consultation regarding that sort of thing, then by all means, go for it. We need you around. So, you know, more power to you. All right. Well, I randomly rambled for long enough. I think that does it for another episode of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for joining me. And if you have any things to say about this, let me know. You can go to our website, psychologyinseattle.com, and contact us. You can also donate there. That'd be nice. So that does it for another episode. Thanks for joining me so much for joining me. Thank you so much for joining me. And please take care of yourself, because you know why? You know why. It's because you deserve it.